The 1,800-plus arrested in New York in August can be inspired by an article published near that time in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Lawrence Wittner, professor of history at the State University of New York at Albany, wrote an article for the Bulletin entitled "The Power of Protest." The article argues that governments gravitate towards using nuclear weapons, and only mass peace movements have slowed them down. I spoke with Lawrence Wittner and asked him about the feeling, believed by many, that protests don't impact society.
When I began this study years ago, I also had that rather pessimistic conclusion, namely, or assumption, namely, that popular resistance to nuclear weapons, and I knew there had been a good deal of that, had not had much impact upon public policy, that the nuclear powers went merrily ahead building more nuclear weapons and indeed had developed them without any concern for popular resistance and revulsion against the nuclear arms race. But as I went through the files of the U.S. State Department and the various presidents and secretaries of defense, as I went through formerly secret Soviet government archives, as I went through formerly secret British government archives and other government records and memoirs, and conducted many, many interviews with former government officials, what I learned was that the movement against nuclear weapons had been very effective, that it had curbed the nuclear arms race and prevented nuclear war, that the arms control and disarmament treaties of the past are not testaments to great power interest in these sorts of things, but rather testaments to popular resistance to the nuclear arms race, resistance that had forced the nuclear powers to accept curbs on their nuclear ambitions, and indeed that prevented most countries that could develop nuclear weapons from developing them.
This is very interesting perspective and kind of flies in the face of the kind of popular expositions of nuclear power and indeed of nuclear weapons that we would hear from the media and from our schools. I'm curious, what were some of the things that you would see in some of these declassified internal government planning documents? Any examples come to mind?
Oh, sure. For example, during the Eisenhower administration, during the 1950s, there were constant meetings of the National Security Council, top secret meetings, and at these meetings, the Secretary of Defense and the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff would speak up and demand a commitment to the future use of nuclear weapons in future U.S. military conflicts. And Secretary of State John Foster Dulles and President Eisenhower resisted this fiercely, and they said, we'd like to be able to commit ourselves to such use of nuclear weapons, but the public won't stand for it. The public, they said, unfortunately doesn't accept the use of nuclear weapons, and they'll turn that around in the future. But until we do, we simply can't move forward along these lines.
I had alluded briefly to there being, or at least I'd like to hear what your assessment is. For a long time, it would seem to me that presentations about the use of nuclear power, the development of nuclear weapons, seem to have a kind of one-sided perspective to them. Like nothing but good could come from such research and from such development, as it would seem, at least to me, from a reading of the media and from people's regular educations, as being the case. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Oh, I think that the mass media and especially governments carried on a ceaseless propaganda campaign to acclimate the public to the prospect of nuclear war and, at the very least, the building of nuclear weapons and the development of nuclear power plants. But the striking thing is that the public didn't buy that. The public continued to be horrified by the development of nuclear power plants and plans for nuclear war, and there developed mass protest movements in the United States led by such groups as the National Committee for Sane Nuclear Policy, the Nuclear Weapons Freeze Campaign, Women Strike for Peace, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and so on, that led public sentiment toward that conclusion that nuclear war and nuclear weapons were disastrous, and therefore the government, rather than getting ready for nuclear war, should begin to move away from plans for it and indeed begin disarmament rather than further armament.
What do you credit as being the source or origination of the of these protest movements in light of the fact that there was this seemingly unending torrent of propaganda basically in support of nuclear war? Where did these protests and organizing come from?
Well, I think it was just some degree of common sense. People from the outset, from the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, recognized that nuclear war would be a disaster, and it indeed had been a disaster in 1945. And therefore, despite the soothing words from government leaders, people simply didn't buy it. Small groups began to form against the nuclear arms race right from the start, right in 1945, and indeed even before 1945, inside the ranks of the atomic scientists, many of whom worked on the atomic bomb project during the Second World War, there developed resistance to the use of nuclear weapons. And a good deal of that occurred in Chicago, even during the Second World War, as the Chicago Met Lab functioned as a place where scientists worked on the Manhattan Project, the atomic bomb project. There was growing resistance to the use of nuclear weapons being produced by some of these same scientists, people like Eugene Rabinowitz and Leo Szilard. And therefore, inside the ranks of the scientists working on the bomb project, there was growing protest against use of the bombs. There were petitions that went around appealing to the president not to use nuclear weapons in the war and warning of the nuclear arms race that would follow any use of these nuclear weapons. And this kind of movement developed after the war into the Federation of American Scientists, into the journal The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, and more broadly into a mass anti-nuclear movement in the United States and, in fact, around the world.
One factor that at least comes to my mind as possibly galvanizing additional support in anti-nuclear and especially anti-nuclear weapon efforts are popular movies that depicted what probably would happen if a nuclear weapon would be deployed. A couple of examples that come to my mind. The British filmmaker Peter Watkins actually developed a film which actually won an Academy Award for Best Documentary here in the United States, in which he actually depicted an attack against a nuclear attack against Britain. And probably here in the United States, more than 20 years ago, the most famous example might be the television movie which aired on ABC called The Day After, which depicted a nuclear attack upon Kansas. Do you think that these kinds of popular expositions helped to fan the flames of anti-nuclear organizing?
I think they did. On the other hand, what's very striking is that the government in the United States and in Britain ferociously resisted these films and their being shown. And I found that out when I went through the government records. The War Game, for example, was kept off the BBC, although it was produced for the BBC. And couldn't be shown in commercial theaters for decades in Great Britain. The film The Day After was ferociously resisted by the U.S. government, which sought to censor it, and in certain ways did censor it, I should note. That is, U.S. government pressure on ABC television led to the altering of the film. And to the setup of a panel after the film showing that was heavily weighted toward proponents of nuclear weapons rather than toward the nuclear freeze campaign, which in fact the poll showed was supported by 70 to 80% of the population. So I think these films were very significant, but you have to look at the context, and the context was the mass media's fairly effectively, and the government's fairly effectively, keeping these films away from the public. Actually, an even more effective film, since it was shown widely, was On the Beach, which was shown during the 1950s and showed the aftermath of nuclear war in Australia as people slowly died from the radiation. And the Eisenhower administration held cabinet meetings to deal with how they were going to counteract the effect of this film. And they were very worried about it, and they sent out bulletins to their various U.S. information officers around the world about how to deal with the public reaction to this film.
Let me follow up with the point you had raised with regards to the day after. In what ways were the government trying to censor ABC or the filmmakers from showing what I suppose would be an original cut of the movie?
They particularly were annoyed about the fact that the firing of the nuclear weapons occurred because of a Soviet fear of U.S. Cruise missiles, and of course the cruise and Pershing missiles, the so-called Euro missiles, were a hot issue during the early 1980s. And furthermore, just generally, they, as the government realized that this would not be a film that would encourage a nuclear buildup, government officials began to worry that any candid portrayal of nuclear war would simply create supporters of the nuclear freeze campaign. And that's what they talked about inside these secret government meetings. And indeed, the government was given copies of the film months in advance so that it could respond to it and it could develop its public relations campaign to counteract the effect of the film. So that ABC, I think, deserves some credit for broadcasting it, but it's also true that ABC collaborated with the U.S. government, censored the film, and indeed warned the filmmaker that unless he accepted censorship, the film would simply not go on the air. And furthermore, saw to it that the government had plenty of time and plenty of advance notice to develop its counter-information program. Mm-hmm.
We've been talking about the past. I was wondering if we could change the topic a little bit to the present. Nowadays, the Cold War has ended and the Soviet specter is no more, but you still nonetheless have a nuclear specter very much on the landscape. Examples include, the current Bush administration has been advocating, or at least mentioning, maybe not necessarily advocating, the use of portable nukes. The examples of use of depleted uranium has elicited some concern, and there's been talk of the deployment of nuclear power plants, possibly in the United States, to generate energy and using global warming as an example for this mass deployment. What other possible nuclear deployments or nuclear uses do you see as being advocated by this administration and perhaps future administrations in coming years?
Well, I think that unfortunately, since the end of the Cold War, the anti-nuclear campaign in the United States has declined, and this has given hawkish politicians around the world, as well as in the United States, a chance to revive the nuclear arms race. So that India and Pakistan, for example, in 1998 exploded nuclear weapons, became nuclear powers, and have subsequently threatened one another with nuclear war. The U.S. Senate rejected the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty negotiated by the Clinton administration, indeed signed by the U.S. government and governments around the world. And the Bush administration has rejected the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. It's pulled out of the ABM Treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. It is going forward with a Star Wars missile defense, or at least a variant on that. And furthermore, it is now in the process of securing funding from Congress for the building of new nuclear weapons, so-called mini-nukes, bunker busters, as they call them sometimes, and is getting ready with new legislation from Congress to resume nuclear testing more rapidly than it could otherwise do. So that the U.S. nuclear machine is now once more rolling forward. Nuclear arms control treaties are being scrapped. People who are concerned about the nuclear arms race, and indeed future nuclear war, I think had better get moving once more and begin to protest and resist this, and at the very least contact their members of Congress who are in the process of voting on these things right now and tell them that they don't want new nuclear weapons. The problem is not that the world doesn't have enough nuclear weapons, but rather that 30,000 nuclear weapons still exist in the world, and it's time to get rid of these through controlled arms control and disarmament treaties.
Mm-hmm. With regards to, I guess, this decline in, I suppose, anti-nuclear agitation, you're also seeing, as I had alluded to earlier, protests which we've seen in recent years of scales that probably dwarf anything that we've probably seen in human history of basically against, in this case, opposition against the war in Iraq and related issues to that. Do you think that the protests from the war in Iraq could help to feed an anti-nuclear anti-nuclear agitation, or where do you see these two trends mixed together, if at all?
Well, I think that, ironically, the Iraq protests and the focus on Iraq by the U.S. peace movement cuts two ways. One way is to simply distract the movement and the mobilizable public from the threat of nuclear war. That is, as people focus on Iraq, they don't look at the Bush administration's proposals in the Republican Congress for building new nuclear weapons and resuming nuclear testing. On the other hand, the protests against the Iraq war have led to the revival of many peace groups. Peace Action, for example, has been growing rapidly for the last few years, thanks to the militarism or the threat posed by the militarism of the Bush administration. And groups like Physicians for Social Responsibility in the United States or the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament in Great Britain and many peace groups around the world are growing as a result of their resistance to the Iraq war. And since these groups are also themselves concerned about the nuclear arms race, they have the potential now for mobilizing people against that nuclear arms race. And to some degree, they do that. Mailings from Physicians for Social Responsibility and Peace Action and so on do stress the dangers of the Bush administration in the nuclear realm. So I think the Iraq war cuts two ways.
That was Professor Lawrence Wittner of the State University of New York at Albany. Professor Wittner has written extensively about peace movements, and his newest book completes a trilogy on the struggle against nuclear weapons, entitled Toward Nuclear Abolition, A History of the World Nuclear Disarmament Movement from 1971 to the Present. Professor Wittner published an article in the July-August 2004 issue of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists titled The Power of Protest. I'm Mitchell Strapinchik, and we're coming to you from the trenches.